Hello and welcome to The Hardy Brain, the show that takes athletic, introverted entrepreneurs and leaders and transforms them into ironclad brain performers. I'm your host, Dr. David Hardy. And today on our show, we've got another amazing guest. He is the CEO of VezTech, a digital transformation evangelicist, and the author of Makers, A Slender Knowledge. Welcome to the show, Sani Abdul-Jabbar. How are you doing today?
I love the way you pronounce my last name. Glad to be here, David.
And I got it correct, right?
You got it perfect.
Excellent. All right. Well, with the book here, I am just going to read the back cover intro to it because I find this fascinating. And then we'll dive into the connections of how this merges with actual digital transformations occurring today in the real world. So here we are. Dr. Adela Dolly, a young ethics scholar, has been invited to join a research team working on a new AI android. Her job is to make sure the AI was programmed with a strong moral compass. She is thrilled, but can't shake the feeling that there is something they aren't telling her. What she discovers is beyond what she ever dreamed. It is both terrifying and exhilarating and will change her life forever. Wow, this sounds like a very intriguing novel and approach how you put in some of these ethical conversations we're having now with technology. How would you describe the book and what are some of the kind of motivators you've had to write this?
Yeah. So let me give you origin story of this book.
Yes.
I didn't set out to write a book on AI and ethics. I'm a capitalist, and some people might find it extreme opposite ethics, capitalism. So,
right.
I attended a retreat 2 years ago in Arizona where I had the good fortune of sitting across the breakfast table from a gentleman by the name of Mr. Mark Victor Hansen. I think you know him. Yeah. He is the author of Chicken Soup for the Soul series.
Absolutely.
Has hundreds of books under his name. And we started talking. He has this strong persona and strong voice. He goes, "So young man, what's your story?" And I started telling him what I do for work. I'm like, you know, I have an emerging tech company in Los Angeles. We build emerging tech. We provide consulting. We provide developers, development services, AI, machine learning, blah, blah. He's like, no, stop right there. That's not your story. What's your story? That's what you do. What's your story?
Right.
And then he said, what matters to you? And we started going back and forth, and kids came up in the conversation, and the future came up in the conversation, and he goes, well, that's your story right there. The question that came up in that conversation, and we went back and forth, was the moment I mentioned AI, he's like, remember Terminator?
Yes.
And he's not the only one who had that thought. Whenever I bring up AI, machine learning anywhere, or even if you Google search AI, a lot of fear what comes up. A lot of, you know, robots are going to take over the world and AI is going to become the masters of humans. And we all know humans, as humans, you know, we are probably not good for ourselves. So if AI determines, even in the best interest of humans, take out humans, right? So right. Those are the kind of scenarios that come to people's mind. But now I'm a parent. And when I think of the future, I'm not just thinking my life. I'm thinking my kids' future and their kids' future, hopefully.
Right. Yeah.
And when I started thinking that in on those timeline, on that horizon, you know, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years, what happens? How do you impact 100 years or 70 years or even 1 year future today? How do you impact that? So I started asking this question. What can we do today in your capacity and my capacity? We are not talking about Elon Musk's and Gates of the world. We're talking about everyday person. What can we do to avoid that kind of future? So I had conversations with people in all walks of life, from philosophers to psychologists to clergy to, I mean, you name it, academics. One of them, a social sciences researcher, He actually, when I asked him, what can we do today to avoid that kind of AI future? He said, he actually responded with a question. Not the best approach, answering question with a question, but that led me to where I am today. He said, if you don't want your kids to do stupid things 20 years from today, what will you do today?
Right.
Well, you give them values. You give them, you know, ethics and more, you know, some wisdom. And he said, well, that's your answer. That's the answer for AI as well. Because AI, as you know, and many of your listeners probably know, you quote unquote train it almost the way you would train a child. The way you raise a child, you expose them to different situations. You expose them to different experiences, or you would give direct knowledge, son, don't do this, don't do that kind of thing. Right. Yes. And the other thing is you're exposing them. You take them shopping and you have them experience the whole shopping experience at a grocery store, for example. Right. So that's the direct interaction. That's how you train AI as well. You basically give it as much information as you can from the previous knowledge. And the AI is then going to learn from that knowledge and build on that knowledge. And that's how it becomes useful. The most popular AI these days, ChatGPT, works the same way. It builds on the previous knowledge. So that's kind of where the idea came from. What can we do today? Well, train it with values. What are the values? And that was the next part of the question. Why most of us humans wake up in the morning and plan world domination, or, you know, hurt our neighbors or kill our friends? Why don't we do that?
Yeah.
Most of us. The reason why we don't do that is because we have these human values, compassion, empathy, kindness, those kind of things. They're instilled in us. They're programmed in our DNA to a degree. And then over the millennia as human race, we have developed those ethics and those values. And then we try to transfer those values to our next generation and next generation as much as we possibly can. Now, can we bring the same values, kindness, compassion, empathy, or those kind of things to the AI realm? And the answer is, yeah, with some consideration, it can be done.
Right. Now, that's what it is, though. Is AI just a reflection of the language we put into it, though? Like, is it just a reflection of all the words we've put down in the history that AI program is able to do? What else would be added on that would actually change that, though?
So the first part of your question is whether AI is a reflection of what we put in. And the answer is yes. You put in lots of data. In the case of ChatGPT, you have all the textual data in it. We have done some work with one of the largest automakers. So in that case of manufacturer, what they wanted to do is they wanted to look at a large number of, you're talking about tens of thousands of videos on YouTube uploaded by their users, owners of their cars, and not all videos, but videos where a certain feature of the car was highlighted. And so we took all those tens of thousands of videos, loaded them to an AI learning program, and taught us how to look for those videos. And we found those videos, and then we did something with it. Now, the next part is did something with it after we identified the videos. Right. So your question is, one thing is you upload the videos. The next thing is upload the data or knowledge. What else can you do? So what else you can do is the data hygiene part.
Okay.
And that's very important. I wanted to talk about it. Why is it important? We all have biases. We all have some sort of phobia towards the other inside us,
right,
in the
absolutely.
Back of our head, right? How do we act on, whether we act on that, those sort of phobias and discriminatory thoughts, or we keep that out of our decision-making so that others don't get impacted by our biases, that's important. But has it always been practiced in human history? No.
Right.
Pick any industry from approving mortgage applications to even healthcare services to government service, pick anything. There are those biases. So when you take that data and bring into AI, you're teaching AI that these biases are part of the equation. You gotta take them into account when you're making your decisions.
Right.
So that's the answer to your next part of the second part of your question. Data hygiene, taking those biases out of the data before it's fed into AI. But then we go into the argument is, you know, who is watching the watchmen and how the people who are cleaning the data, you know, how they avoid their own biases.
Well, that's a big one too, because depending, you mentioned Elon Musk and the Bill Gates of the world. Yeah. So depending on whichever billionaire hero or villain you subscribe to, there's all sorts of ways that things can be manipulated. And then you look at big tech or big government, and how does individuals then, with this massive thing, we always already know technology enslaves us in modern eras, protect or do something about that?
So on a day-to-day basis, a realization that a decision that you're making today in any capacity, you know, at you at your clinic or me at my office or anyone else in their organizations, whatever, they're in that role, your decision is not impacting the one person that you're making that decision about. It's not temporary decision. This decision, today's decisions are tomorrow's data for AI training. So if I can leave your audience with this one thought, today's decisions are tomorrow's data. Today's choices are tomorrow's data that we're going to use to train AI. Then you have to realize that whatever you're doing today, whatever decisions you're making today in your capacity, whatever you are, you're adding to that data, right? So you can't say, oh, some AI conspiracy is out to get us. Well, you're kind of part of it, right? Mm-hmm. So at small scale, but it the way AI works is you teach it one thing, then it's going to build on that. So if the foundation is crooked, the top is going to be crooked too, right? And the way AI works, you teach, if you use, we're talking about Elon Musk, so Tesla's example, you may have heard of this thing called phantom braking. So phantom braking is when the car is going on the road and all of a sudden, for no apparent reason, it just stops. And imagine you're going on driveway, on a freeway at 70 miles an hour, and you just boom, stop all of a sudden. You know, so many Tesla cars, it's a problem, right? So many Tesla cars, they get rear-ended. Why that happened? Because at some point, either some engineer or some cars determine that when there is an object coming towards you, regardless how close it is, that's dangerous. So you got to stop, right? And the cars kept doing it. And then every time there is an update to the system or another car experienced the same thing. So there's this fallacy too. One car stopped and the car noticed that it didn't get into an accident. So the result of that experience is if you stop suddenly, you will not get into an accident. It's going to share that information to all its sister cars, millions of cars in the fleet. They're all going to start doing the same thing. And the issue becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. The point that I'm trying to make here is even the smallest decision that we make today, it can have that kind of, you know, very long lasting impact.
Right. So how do we edit this and stay on top of things when we're programming different systems? So these catastrophes are hopefully avoidable. 'Cause usually people kind of type, click, program something and let it go.
Yeah. Well, first of all, read the book. Read Makers. Shameless pitch.
Actually, so let's build on top of that, though. What's one of the ethical or moral kind of dilemmas one of your character goes through?
So one of the characters in the book is a piece of AI that is sent. It's a robot, humanoid robot, looks like a robot, feels like a robot. That's a key phrase. So this is a self-aware piece of artificial intelligence. And the idea, the concern is not how it's going to interact and behave and react to humans. The bigger concern is how humans are going to react to it. We don't like the other. That's a problem, right? Our mentality, for the most part, globally, is still very tribal. And as you know, tribes are small. Once you grow larger than a certain size, it breaks into other tribes. So that mentality is there. Now you're introducing AI, which is an other, right? So the fear is totally understandable. So this robot he is sent in different environments. And he's sent to work at a grocery store, for example, as a person who unpacks the deliveries when they come in and puts them on the shelves and stuff and interacts with the customers. And they find out that it's actually the people who have more problem with the robot versus the other way around.
Right.
And then the same robot is sent to work on to fix freeways with the inmates. You know how in the U.S. they deploy inmates to work on these public service projects. And then the robot is sent over there and it's working alongside those workers. And then it's sent in other environments like that to work. Because what I was really trying to sort of explore is AI in workplace. What's the biggest threat in AI in workplace? Well, AI is going to take over your job, right? That's the common question that's asked. I've been advocating that it's not AI that's going to take over your job. It's the use of AI, the person who knows on the other side who what to do with the AI. So if we started thinking it's Dr. Hardy versus the AI, then it's a problem. But if we think Dr. Hardy plus AI, a hybrid type approach, then it's not a problem. What happened in the book is that when this robot goes to work with humans, humans didn't think of him as human plus the robot. Robot has more physical power, more intellectual power, more learning ability, more of everything than a human. But a human did not consider it plus versus thought of it. Instead, it considered it versus, against the other.
Right.
And that's what the whole exploration is about. How we can behave differently to work alongside robots. Now, in terms of working together, I'll share one example with you. We did a project, completed a project recently in the UAE. It's a group of therapists, and they meet their clients, patients or clients, I don't know what the proper term is, once a week.
Okay.
And the question was, well, we're meeting with our clients once a week. What happens during the week?
Exactly.
So, right, during the week. So whatever they're prescribing, whether it's an exercise or meditation, whatever that might be, is the patient doing all those things? Now, the patient comes back a week later, tells the therapist whether they followed through the prescription or not. And then the therapist would say something, make changes, adjustments, etc. Now the patient goes back for one whole week. The therapist doesn't know what's going on. Patient comes back and the circle keeps going. And we were told that actually compliance with the prescribed exercises or prescribed non-pharmaceutical alternative health methods, that compliance was the issue. Patients wouldn't follow through. So we came up with this idea, why not we take all as much knowledge as we can from the therapists, load that into an AI, it's a custom trained AI, the interface is an app or a web application, and the patient can interact with this AI therapist throughout the week, whenever they want, around the clock. So what happened is that the prescription compliance rate went up, the satisfaction level from the service went up, and we discovered something really interesting, and that was, the patients, they started talking to the AI and started sharing stuff that they weren't sharing with their therapist.
I've heard of that, yes.
Now, that's the oddest thing, because why I find it ironic, because the therapist reminds the patient in every meeting that whatever you say is confidential, it's not recorded, I take notes only for my own purpose. Everything you say, it's in confidence. So feel free to say whatever. You won't be judged. Your information won't be. On the other hand, in the case of AI, the beta testers that we worked with, we told them up front, everything that you say is going to get recorded. We're going to use it to train the system further. And if we need, we can actually go back and listen to your conversation with the AI. And still, humans actually gave more information, more personal, more intimate information to the AI versus to a human therapist. Wow. Now, we're not talking about taking the human therapist out of the equation. We're talking about merging the two together. Now, when the therapist knows that this patient has followed through all the prescribed whatever they were told to do during the week, and also they're giving more information, now the therapist is more capable, more able to help this patient because the therapist has more information. So that's how I see, at least in the medium term future, humans, and even in the long term future, AI and humans working together in a hybrid fashion. But it's more on us. How do we learn to accept that reality?
Exactly. And that's a lot of data coming through. And when it does come down to, say, a therapist, clinician, whatever, practitioner, time is always an issue as well. So I would imagine, too, there's ways to teach the machines to pick up kind of the nuggets that come out of all the things that was recorded as well, right?
Precisely. So emotional AI is another concept that's evolving. And the idea is AI can listen to you or read your content, and it can sense the emotional undertones. It can detect the emotional undertones in that conversation. And then based on that, and then the next step is what to do with it, actionable outcomes, actionable insights. So once you know there are these emotional undertones, depending on whichever profession you're in, whichever profession you're implementing that AI in, you can take, if you're a therapist, you can take that information. If I'm telling you a story, but my emotional undertone is flat, you know, I might be making up a story, or I am showing less distress than the story suggests that I should be showing, right? So that, as a therapist, or in your line of work, you know, pain. How do you define pain, right?
Right.
Right. So on a scale from 1 to 10, my 10 is different than your 10. So
that's exactly
it doesn't work. Right.
See this really integrating with different biomarkers as well. Yeah. So you already mentioned one, different inflections of somebody's mm-hmm. voice. A trained ear in a human can pick that up right away and look at the facial mm-hmm. expressions and be like, no, you're lying. Or there's something you're not telling me. But this is now possible to quantify that in individuals through different technology as well. What are some of the watch out for things? And then, of course, we've already mentioned the potential, but what other kind of potentials have we not talked about yet with this?
Well, so the main things that we talked about so far is, one is, it's AI is here. It's not going away. So get used to it. So get used to it. Accept it. Second, bring it in your life. Think of it as plus you, not versus you. You know, unless you don't, you know, I mean, there are very few professions that aren't going to get impacted by AI. Knowledge workers, anyone who works, who doesn't work with their hands directly. So first of all, they shouldn't even think for a moment that they are irreplaceable, regardless if you are an attorney or whatever you are. When I say irreplaceable, I'm not talking about taking that person out of the job. I'm talking about using attorney as an example, another attorney who gets very comfortable with AI tools, that's the biggest threat to you as an attorney.
Absolutely.
Right? Even if you work with your hands, in your case, or in case of therapists who talk and all that, I just shared the case study where information, the more information available, better service can be provided, deeper understanding of the patient's challenges can be acquired through these tools. So that's that. If you're an organization, AI is a competitive advantage now. And what we're seeing is that when we talk to, so we spend a lot of money on research every year, and a big question, two questions that we've been asking this year is whether CEOs and business leaders, they understand the value of AI. Do they see AI as competitive advantage? And the answer is absolutely yes. Are they investing in that? Are they investing in bringing these emerging tech into their organizations? Less than 14%.
Wow.
And someone told me actually that even 14%. That's the low. And I've been told that even 14% is probably a questionable number. But anyway, it's low, pretty low. So why is that? I believe the reason is everyone knows it's a competitive advantage, but people are struggling with, and the leaders are struggling with finding the trailhead. Where do I start? What do I do first?
Now, this is also big companies, right? Now, is this more of a democratization then? Does a small creative type person in whatever field have more of an advantage now because their productivity can shoot up versus a multinational company who's trying to integrate so many different people together and push in some sort of AI system on top of that? Is it a period where those freelance type people out there are now at an advantage point versus maybe a corporation and moving to something new and innovative?
So let's see if I can answer that question. So individuals at developer level or builder level, makers level, they can perform, first of all, they have now the freedom of learning more higher level skills, more advanced level skills, because they don't have to spend a lot of time in mundane tasks. It's basic code, you know, you can churn out in like no time with these AI products. Even writing, even marketing your service, like that's taken care of. So now you have the freedom of focusing and concentrating on things that truly matter. More higher level knowledge, more higher level thinking, more complex tasks that you can handle better. So that's that. Although building large AI systems is expensive, it's an expensive undertaking. I recently read somewhere that currently in 2023, we are using about 4% of the world's electricity on AI systems. By the end of 2024, we forecast about 8% of the world electricity.
Wow.
Right? And it's right. So it's very expensive. Beast. It's a hungry beast. And then the rise from there is exponential. And once AI starts building AI, then the speed is just going to be off the charts. So we have that much hunger for energy, that much hunger for resources. Point that I'm trying to make is that this is not a cheap undertaking. This is not a developer sitting, you know, somewhere by himself or herself building stuff. Right. This is large corporations, large organizations, governments. It's that level of work. Now, small tools can be built. You may have seen plugins. You may have seen add-ons on top of Chrome browser or other things that, yes, they can be built on, say, on top of ChatGPT, for example, or a custom GPT can be created. But if you really are talking about building large AI systems, that's a very expensive, very large undertaking. So if you're an organization...
So if we look at it as basically infrastructure versus kind of store level, it's precisely two different things.
Precisely.
Okay.
If you're an organization and you're looking to bring AI into your systems, into your organization, first of all, it's a very new skill. So traditional IT teams, they tend not to have the right kind of skills. They have the inside knowledge, obviously. They have the knowledge of the business. They're subject matter experts on everything operational inside. But in order to bring...
if the regular Joe in tech isn't fluent in this, this is where your company comes in, isn't it? Like, this is where you guys excel, is bringing in those people that are innovative on the digital transformation edge. Am I correct on that? That is what?
Absolutely. So we did a project for TSA. The project was funded by the DHS, Department of Homeland Security of the United States. This was a few years ago. And they said, well, we want to bring blockchain. We want to bring blockchain into our operations, especially in the identity area where we need to identify people more effectively. How can that be done? Said, okay. Yes. So we started from that one question, went through the whole discovery and consultation and advisory, and finally got to a point where we had something that can be built, and then we presented to them and all that. That's where my company excels. We have something called Emergence Convergence Framework. It's an emerging tech forecasting formula. So we know what technologies are coming down the pike. In the past, it used to be 2 to 3 years. Now it's about 12 to 14 months because change has become much faster in the post-COVID days. So because of that reason, we have people, we have resources, we have infrastructure. So if an IT company or an IT team or an IT consulting firm, they want to bring emerging technologies such as blockchain, AI, machine learning, those sort of things into their operations, or if they want to start offering it to their organization or their outside clients, they don't have to worry about upfront cost, upfront investment, or upfront acquiring those skills, because we bring plug and play knowledge and developers and resources. So all you need to have is budget and idea. Budget is very important.
I love it.
Right? So that's our magic.
Yeah. Essentially, so do you work zero. With small Joes as well, or mainly the larger entities, or anything in between?
No, we work with everybody. It's just that, as I shared earlier, if you're building larger systems, the cost of that, the budgets required, is just very high. If you're doing something at a presentation, so if you say, I want to have, David AI, Dr. Hardy AI, right?
Ooh,
so that's,
I like it already.
Right? So, well, I have created Sunny AI, actually. That's based on my previous writings from the last 10, 15 years. And literally, it can be done. So everything starts with data. So if you have data of your work, for example, or your writings from the last, whatever number of years, we can take all that. This is a small scale thing. So I'm trying to answer your question. Do we work with a regular person, an individual who doesn't have very large budget? Yeah, we can. But the value that we really bring is at a medium to large scale corporations. And because data is required, and an individual most likely is not going to have data. It's only larger organizations.
There's a lot of people listening that are in those entities and that are looking for that creative solution or that piece of the puzzle they're missing. And it really sounds like you smooth over a lot of kind of the conflict and missing gaps in this. And let's zoom out then onto the massive scale here, since we've got you as such an amazing expert on this field. Is, you mentioned the energy suck and then the integration of this and how quickly it could take off, and then the ethical dilemmas, and nothing in disruption is smooth. There's always some chaos and then kind of greener pastures in what I've experienced. But what are your predictions on the implementation of this into society? And if you had a crystal ball and had to predict what's going to happen in a couple years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, what would be your predictions?
So my prediction is that think about the next decade, starting from year 2030. At that point, and then I'll work backwards from there. So during that decade, I believe, and this is not just my opinion, this is in line with many other people in the industry, people way smarter than me. And they're all thinking that we are moving towards a future where there's digital representations of us, whether it's physical or digital. That's going to become more common. Although during the next decade, it's going to be most likely digital representation. So think digital double or digital persona or avatar per se.
Okay.
Now work backwards from there. So this digital persona, it's not just, changing your face on the screen while we are talking. We are talking about actually a digital double of Dr. Hardy attending 10 different meetings simultaneously when Dr. Hardy is having, his coffee in the morning. Right. Okay. So Dr. Hardy is not even there. Right. So it says digital doubles who are attending meetings and meeting patients and interviewing guests on his podcast. So imagine that. To get to that point, what do we need? There are enabling technologies, and there are three or four different areas in which those technologies are likely to evolve. One we already been talking about. That's the psychological and social aspect of it. Do we accept that or not? How do we interact with it? Is there the whole ethical aspects and all that stuff? So that's one category. The other is the backend infrastructure category. That's where things like blockchain and machine learning and more advanced models of AI. Currently, what we have, it's very early stage models that we are working with in the AI space. So advancement of those models, that's likely to happen over the next, we have six years left in this decade now. So that's likely to happen. Then there's the presentation.
I said that's a quick time frame.
That's a quick time frame, but the way AI is evolving, speed is very high. So I wouldn't be surprised if in 6 years, you know, if we are still in this world and we talk, it may be you and I actually not talking, and maybe our, you know, doubles talking to each other. I hope not. I like hanging out with you.
Exactly.
So then you have the presentation layer. That's where the actual visuals of that. Metaverse, you have heard of Metaverse. So Metaverse is one of those things. It kind of didn't become mainstream as the company Facebook, at that time it was Facebook, now it's Meta, the way they were hoping and many others were hoping. It didn't become mainstream because I don't think we were ready for it. But that's the future, 6, 7 years, 10 years down the road. And then I can keep going, but these are the general directions, like technologies that can enable us to get to that point where our digital doubles, digital representations, they can go out and do things on our behalf.
So just like the book, it is terrifying and exhilarating at the same time. I love it.
I hope I can help calm some of those fears. Really, my message is hope. And I think there is hope if we take, if we play our part today instead of waiting for someone else to do it.
Absolutely. This is such an amazing field and changing by the millisecond. And I really appreciate your time, wisdom, and knowledge on everything AI and digital transformation, diving into the human side, the ethics, all these massive conversations that are just now getting awareness to them, and the lead you're taking on it, and the lead that VesTech is doing as well. How do people find more information about yourself? How do they get your book? What sort of advice would you like to leave people with a little bit more hope with then as well?
I write quite frequently on LinkedIn, Forbes, other platforms. The easiest way to get in touch with me is on LinkedIn. So it's my name, Sani, S-A-N-I, linkedin.com/in/Sani. I'm sure you'll share the link on your podcast page.
Yes.
I try to share my thoughts, research coming out of the labs, reviews coming out of, you know, other scholars in the industry and other practitioners. I try to share those as much as possible on LinkedIn and through other forums. But LinkedIn is the easiest way to connect with me. The book Makers is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all other booksellers. So it's just a matter of Google search.
Perfect. All right. Well, once again, thank you for your time, knowledge, wisdom, and expertise. And for everyone, stay tuned to the next episode of The Hardy Brain, the show that takes athletic, introverted entrepreneurs and leaders and transforms them into ironclad brain performers. Take care.